Yours to Protect, brought to you by Cork's Red FM, the Eye, the Eye, and funded by Comisión na Mban with a television licence fee. Check out ourstoprotect.ie for more info.
Ours to Protect is a new weekly feature on Cork's Red FM where we meet the change makers, the activists and the go-getters who aim to make Cork City and County a greener, sustainable and more enjoyable place to live in. Over the course of the series, we'll be exploring everything from the city beekeepers to community gardens and gain an insight to some innovative ideas by these local legends. To start the series, I'm joined by Maria Young of Green Spaces for Health and the Cork Food Policy Council and Gina Johnson, Climate Action Officer at the Cork City Council. Thank you for joining me in studio today.
You're very welcome. Good to be here.
To kickstart the show, Gina, would you mind giving our listeners an insight to your role and what is you do at the Cork City Council?
Sure, Elaine. So I'm the Climate Action Officer, part of the Climate Action Unit or in Cork City Council. I work alongside our Community Climate Action Officer, Peter Medway, climate graduate Daniel Carr, and our boss Paul McGurk. We work really as part of a bigger team in strategic economic development.
And Maria, would you mind telling me about yourself?
I work with Green Spaces for Health, which is a project of Cork Healthy Cities, and I also work with the Cork Food Policy Council. So Green Spaces for Health are very much about green spaces and catering for biodiversity and bringing community together. And then Cork Food Policy Council is more concerned, I guess, with food and the growing of food and all sorts of things related to food.
So Gina, to start, could you tell me about the Cork City Climate Action Plan? I know it plays a vital role in collaborating with community-led organisations such as Green Spaces for Health and the Cork Food Policy Council, I'm sure. How important is it to collaborate with these community groups and rolling out these projects?
It's fundamental, really, Elaine. I suppose just to explain the Climate Action Plan, we are, as a country, we have a statutory obligation to be net zero, to be climate neutral by 2050. And by 2030, we're looking to reduce our emissions by 41%. And that's under the Climate Action Plan for the country. Now, at the moment, each local authority in the country is producing a local climate action plan. And for Cork City, we have until February 24, we have to have our plan in place. Really, to do that, we have a good idea of what we need to do, but it's how to do it, and that's where communities are going to be absolutely vital. As part of the national plan, we have funding of €840,000 that's specifically for a community climate action project. It's funding. For the next few weeks, that fund is still open, and it is open to any community group and our organisation for projects really that lower our carbon footprint. That's in broad terms.
Yeah.
So that is really the bedrock. The communities, I think, are going to be absolutely critical for us as a city reaching our targets for 2030 and 2050.
Green Spaces for Health are one of the many organisations collaborating with the council. And through your work, you maintain existing green spaces, but also seek out greening opportunities in the city. And in a city that's building and thriving, can you tell me some of these initiatives you're rolling out?
Yeah, so we're working a lot with community gardens. We set up several community gardens post-COVID, largely in public parks with Cork City Council. So we work a lot with Toker Community Garden. We're there two or three times a week, actually, and we run a lot of projects out of that garden. But aside from that, we also work a lot in Park Owen, which is just off Quaker Road. That's a former cemetery, and that's also kind of like a little bit like Toker. It's like a laboratory where we try different ideas out. So, and then we've got projects going on all across the city in different places, including schools, public parks, as I mentioned, and then other areas that are public spaces. So Park Owen, for example, we have a tree nursery there, and that all came out of the tree audit that we conducted with the School of Bees UCC some years ago. And the idea there was to map and measure, identify all as many trees as possible from let's say in the eastern side of the city by the City Hall right up to UCC. And we mapped and identified about 1,100 trees. And what came out of that was that only 18% were native. So that's influenced a lot of our tree work since. So every year we plant a load of trees. We also collect the fruit from a lot of trees with schools. We have huge school projects on across the city. I think there's about 1,000 acorns now in different schools around the place in purpose-built boxes that we provided. And then we put them into nurseries so that they get a kind of a head start in life.
Yeah.
And we've nurseries now dotted around the city, and that all started in Park Owen. And I have to say that we got that idea. We worked closely with Trees Please. They're another organisation in the north side of the city, and they're doing terrific work up there. They're planting loads of trees every year. They've got tree nurseries as well. So between us, we're covering a lot of ground with the trees. It's great to be able to go to, like, there was an old oak now down in Jacob's Island, and it must have yielded thousands of acorns. So we would have collected a lot of those.
Yeah.
And so we're trying to really keep local, you know, with the trees, not just so we're not importing and we're not buying. Mm-hmm. We're just trying to do our little bit to plug that gap.
When you say tree nursery, can you kind of paint an image for the listener of what that entails?
I'm glad you asked that, actually, because sometimes when people hear a tree nursery, they think it's very elaborate and maybe large.
Yeah.
You can install a tree nursery anywhere, and the trees are very closely planted together because it's only a temporary residence for them, really.
Yeah.
So we've got ones, for example, in St. Finbar's Hospital. That was the last one we put in, and there's about 100 trees in there. And all sorts of native trees, and they're in rows. And then next year, they'll have grown maybe a couple of feet tall, some of them, depending on the species, and then we'll take them out.
Yeah.
The one in Park Owen is only about, I'd say, 4 metres by 3 metres. And in schools, you literally could do it in a metre squared, you know?
Yeah.
So it's just packing a lot of trees into a small area, just for them to, I suppose, grow a little bit taller before you plant them out. All in all, we planted 1,000 trees last year. This February.
This February alone.
Yeah.
A busy time for you, so.
Yes, the tree time has passed, and now I'm into the food growing season, and it's equally busy, yeah. Where one thing kind of, you know, goes down, another comes up, so it's now the food growing.
Yeah, and now speaking of food growing, another initiative that you carry out is the Seed Library, in which fruit and veg seeds are available at Holyhill City Library. Can you explain to the listener how that came to fruition?
What happened was that I was giving a guided tour to people around St. Finbar's Cathedral about 2 years ago, and there was a gentleman in the group, and he was from County Wicklow, and he said they had a seed library up in County Wicklow, and I remember thinking, God, we have to have one of those. I was really taken with the idea. Yeah. And I went about it straight away, and we met the librarian, Elizabeth, and she was very much up for it. And we set it up, and then we contacted Madeline McKeever from the Brown Seed Envelope Company in Skibbereen in West Cork, and Madeline came up and did a workshop on how to harvest seed. And then we purchased with a grant seed for the library. So people go to the library, and much as you might borrow a book, you borrow your seed. For example, if it was cabbage seed, you take it to the desk, you check it out, they note your email address, and then you plant your cabbage, you harvest to eat 3/4 of it or however many you want, and then you leave one or two go to seed, which means you leave it in the ground for a lot longer, and the natural cycle of the plant then is to go to seed, and then you collect the seed, you dry it, and you bring it back to the library. So that's the idea. And a lot of the community gardens have already bought into it, and they've started donating seed. Ard Foyle have donated seed. Some of the horticultural colleges have donated seed. So it's great. It's ongoing, you know.
Yeah.
And I think what it will do is promote learning on how you harvest seed, you know, so that we can retain some of our crops and we're not so dependent on maybe imported seed.
Yeah.
So we've also provided some workshops, and I think we'll have to do several more because each sort of vegetable family is a bit different, you know.
Yeah.
It'll take time, but at least we started it. And so far, there's been a huge uptake.
And for someone listening at home who might not have a notion as to how to plant seeds or garden or, you know, do something by themselves at home, workshops are available for them to come and join and actually gain an insight, and it's very accessible for them.
Yes, and one of the great things about it is the envelopes that the seeds are in. They're kind of homemade envelopes, and like if you donate seed, you're asked to leave your email address, so somebody else might pick up the seed who may not have grown that particular vegetable or flower, and they can email you. That's one of the kind of agreements. Yeah. And they can ask you for advice, seeing as you already grew it and harvested it. So it's kind of a network as well. It's going to create, hopefully, a network of people communicating with one another, you know. The library also purchased a great amount of books on what to do and how to do it. Of course, anybody can go into one of the community gardens and get advice in the community gardens as well. So,
So it really highlights, Gina, that like collaboration is key, and the council does play a big role with the Community Climate Action Plan in facilitating not only just funds but spaces for these community groups to flourish in. And as we can see, the network between Green Spaces for Health, the community gardens, the Cork City Library, you know, council is really important as well in helping provide green spaces for the people in the city. Can you tell me about any other community organisations that the council works with, or any initiatives being rolled out from a community perspective?
I suppose you're right about the space. Maria has been central to a lot of the work that we've done collaboratively in the community. Our parks section have been fantastic. We have a tree officer who's done wonderful work planting 4,500 trees last year. I think there's 5,000 trees. So it's all building on what the communities are doing and working in collaboration with the different residents' associations and community associations. We now have two biodiversity officers in the City Council who really are important at looking forward to, I suppose, nature-based solutions to the climate. Yeah. And that'll work so perfectly in tandem with what Maria and all the Marias around the city have been doing, although we could do with some more
Marias.
Because this woman is an inspiration. If you ever get a chance to go on one of Maria's walks around the city centre, it's just eye-opening. They're so important, not just to sort of physical health, but to our mental health, you know, the importance of green space. So the council would be very aware of, you know, the significance of all these small projects that work there, you know, as a whole. They bring the city together and make it a much healthier place to live in.
Yeah, and the thing is, the pandemic really highlighted people's need for green spaces, for relaxation, leisure purposes, activities. How is the city kind of creating more of these spaces to meet people's needs, like using existing spaces, but also, I suppose, as the city is thriving and there is building going on, how can we create greener spaces to meet the demands of the growing population?
Sure. I mean, that would be part, very much a core pillar, I suppose, of our development plan. So our planners would be very aware of the need for green and blue infrastructure.
Yeah.
New developments will have a certain amount of green space. We would be looking towards sort of having green roofs, green walls, all the small but really important ways in which a city can breathe, literally breathe more healthily. The parks, I suppose, are vital. We have some wonderful parks that are, you know, really during, I think, like you say, during the lockdowns, that's when people appreciated that open outdoor space. And we had the wonderful initiative with the park rangers who interacted, I think, really well with people. And I guess what was important about the park rangers as well was how they fed back into the council, you know, how people were using the space, maybe things we were missing out on, outdoor water fountains, you know, for drinking water, small little things like that that make public space just so much more pleasant and useful.
One thing that we obviously don't get to see is the use of rooftops in Cork. Now, we might be aware of Cork's rooftop farm, but people may not be aware of the beehive at St. John's rooftop. So could you give our listeners just an insight into that and how it came about?
I think I got that job with Green Spaces for Health in 2019, and we had a public consultation And I was trying to, at the time, figure out where could we put a beehive in a very built-up area, you know. And we had the public consultation in St. John's, and Paula McCarthy is the principal there. She's a wonderful woman. And she just jumped on the idea straight away. I didn't have to persuade her. Now, luckily, there was a student there at the time who was very much into bees and had a little bit of experience. So we got together with the student and Paul and a few more of the staff. And we began to look into, well, what would we have to do to get a beehive up on the rooftop? So Paula had to go off and sort of do a health and safety audit, let's say. And in the meanwhile, we contacted Mark Reardon of Hivemind. And Mark runs this company called Hivemind down in Myrtleville. So you could buy a hive and Mark will do all the work and you get the honey. So he's very experienced. And Mark agreed to come up and help us start off, you know. So he brought up a nook of 3,000 honeybees. Wow. And that soon expanded to 70,000. you know, it just exploded, like, and
buzzing around South Harris, and we don't know about it.
This is it, yeah. And so it's up on, I suppose, is it the fourth or the fifth? Is it four or five stories high? It's high anyway. It's the outdoors, up on top. What happens now is every week Mark goes up, and several people from Green Spaces go up with him, and various other people from the college go up every week to keep an eye on them, particularly in the summer. And it's been a huge success. Mm. And Mark would say it's one of the best hives he has. Wow. And it kind of told us that there's plenty of forage in the city for these bees. Now, we did start a whole campaign to get people in the area growing for the bees of South Parish. Yeah. And that led to the conversation about, well, what do bees actually eat? What are the different species of plant mm-hmm. that they favour? Some of the college modules got involved, like the business module got involved. They designed the jars for the honey, and the environmental class got involved as well. I think they began to monitor the bees, and the excitement that first year. So they're doing their own thing. And I mean, Paula was a great woman to do it, because a lot of people would have been fearful, particularly when there's mm-hmm. a creche. There's a secondary school and a third level there. Mm-hmm. And there hasn't been one incident. I think sometimes we have a fear about these things that doesn't ever, you know, mm-hmm. Come to fruition.
Irrational fear.
Yeah, there we are a bit. Now, I would say, like, I'm not going to be installing, or I'm not going to kind of be the instigator of another beehive in South Parish, because, you know, you begin to realise that amount of bees. There's been studies coming out now to show that they are in competition with the other bees, and we have to be careful about this. It's wonderful, but they're not in danger the way the bumblebee, the mining bee, the solitary bee are. And these are the poor little fellas that nobody kind of takes notice of, and they don't give us the honey. Yeah. So we've got to start watching out for those. We've got to start watching out for, you know, very common, that aren't so common anymore, insects, moths, butterflies, all those. We're going to have to become very good now at, I suppose, appreciating what types of plants to plant for those particular species, you know. So imagine if we had several hives across that part of the city. You know, you're really, there's only so much forage there, and it could drown out the others, so we have to be careful about that, I think.
I'm not really aware of kind of specific plans for you know, converting to green within the city. Mm-hmm. I think that's sort of developing.
Yeah,
sort of as we begin to push forward with the plans. But I mean, there's no doubt there are so many flat roofs across the city that could be taking solar, and that'll be a huge thing. We have a pilot scheme at the moment with Belfast City Council, where we're looking at the possibility of putting solar panels into a number of our own buildings, of the City Council buildings on top. So that, you know, when it's only when you see the city from somewhere like the top of St. John's that you realise just how many flat spaces we have that would be absolutely ideal for green roofs, for solar panels, for, I don't know, water harvesting, for so many different projects. The potential is great. I know there's probably always an insurance issue, or there mm-hmm. may be a structural masonry issue. I don't know, but we do have to start looking. at all these, really to see how, when you see, sometimes when you see what they've been doing abroad, somewhere like Denmark, where, you know, they have green gardens on top of, you know, half their buildings in, yeah, in some of the cities, and that really makes you excited, can thinking what we could do, you know, if we can just, yeah, like, I suppose it is, I guess, financing is probably an issue, mm-hmm, for a lot of building owners, or you know, the complexity of being a tenant, maybe a tenant business in the city, you know, yeah, that you can't necessarily do what you want to do. Yeah. But it's definitely huge potential. There's also a placemaking fund, you know, for communities that can suggest ways to make the environment in the city, I suppose, less hard. Well, I think, excuse me, it's a cultural as well as an environmental, mm-hmm, fund, but to make the place, just to make it a bit more vibrant, a bit more conducive to, you know, sort of public interaction, like Maria has with the gardens,
yeah,
you know, maybe in the heart, in the core of the city, to, yeah, have more space that we can use for events.
And the other good news is that Cork is part of the EU's 100 Mission Cities project, which is an ambitious project where 100 EU cities aim to be carbon neutral by 2030. How is this going? How is it being rolled out?
Okay, so this is a hugely ambitious programme, and it's ourselves in Dublin have signed, we were accepted as one of the 100 mission cities. I suppose nobody really believes that we can do it, but I think that's always a good challenge, especially for Cork people.
Absolutely, you know, we have to take the challenge.
We do, and we like to prove people wrong.
Yeah.
So what it's done really is it has, I suppose, spurred us into accelerated mode. So we know we have to reach 51% reduction by 2030. That's statutory, but the mission has really pushed us that bit further. We're beginning now, as part of the mission and as part of our climate action plan, we've been doing the sort of establishing our baselines, figuring out where are we at the moment, because, you know, we had piecemeal information, but to get an actual baseline that we can judge ourselves from. So UCC have just completed that baseline emissions. So it tells us exactly where, what sector is producing what kind of level of emissions at the moment. And as I suppose, as we expected, it's households and traffic, mm-hmm, in the city that are producing the most greenhouse gases.
And you also mentioned transport, and I know there's like cycle lanes being rolled out across the city as well, and electronic vehicles as well are becoming a lot more popular. Can we see the introduction of perhaps more charging ports throughout the city?
I suppose we know that by 2030 they won't be producing any more ICE, as they're called, but petrol or diesel cars in, mm-hmm, in the EU. So we are going to be moving more to EVs. They're not the panacea. You know, mm-hmm, they're still exploiting huge amounts of kind of earth, precious earth minerals, and desperate, yeah, mining to provide all the batteries and what have you for the EVs. But, yeah, they're infinitely cleaner. So we would be supporting that. It's a national policy to support the rollout of it. As part of that, one of my colleagues, Tony Lynch, who's one of our, he's our sustainable transport engineer. Tony has been developing with his colleagues a strategy for the rollout of EV charging infrastructure,
yeah,
in the city. And he's really been looking, I suppose you have to look at it from a pragmatic point of view, but you also have to look at it from a social point of view. So, mm-hmm, that we try to transition in a just way. Mm-hmm. So we're looking in particular at areas where people may not have driveways where they can put in their own, yeah, chargers. So those areas we'd be focusing on to say, okay, you know, where can we put public parking, mm-hmm, public charging in those areas? And because there are quite a few, and when you think about apartment living, you, yeah, know, particularly in the city centre, mm-hmm, but there are also estates out in the suburbs where you know, your parking space isn't next to your house. It might be divided by a path, or you have to walk over to it. So it's the logistics of how it would happen. Then this, of course, we're still really at an early stage
in it.
So, yeah, that's all being developed at the moment. We're now hosting a series of, we're calling them climate conversations, meetings with different sectors. So the public sector, we held a climate conversation with community sectors, and we will be hosting one for the private sector this week. I suppose for us in the council, these are incredibly important sessions because we are listening and we want to hear what people feel about climate, how you know, what worries them, mm-hmm. what ideas they have, you know, what are we doing right in their eyes, what are we doing wrong, you know, how we can, we really feel we're on a journey together in this one. There's no such thing as us telling anybody, you know, what to do. It has to be, you know, a partnership. It has to be working together on it. So all this is building up to the mission plan and the climate action plan. The actions then will be informed by these
the findings of the survey.
Yeah, and the conversations in particular.
And Maria, how important is it for these community-led organisations to participate in these talks with the council, sharing ideas and feedback for potential future projects?
Absolutely essential, really, because we depend on the council quite a bit for, as you mentioned earlier, space and that. And just referring to something that Gina said earlier, it's absolutely wonderful that we have two biodiversity officers now in the city.
Yeah.
So we work a lot now with, in particular, Rosemary MacDonald. And Rosemary, for example, came out to Toker and we did a biodiversity blitz, which was counting all the species in one day. Rosemary herself is a bird expert, and she identified 20 different species of birds that morning. We couldn't believe it.
Yeah.
And then we had somebody like, it was Catherine Seal, look at the river. And that was really interesting because the River Glasheen flows behind the garden there in Toker, and it's just great to bring local people together to look at the rivers and the streams. We're all familiar with the River Lee, but there's a lot of streams there that we don't. And then we had somebody else then look at the insects and someone else look at the plant life. So actually, I read an email this morning that Rosemary sent out, and she really wants to meet with the likes of ourselves and other community groups to go walk about and see where else can we help those beautiful birds like the grey wagtail, for example, that's on the red list. What can we do in our locales to support them? Mm-hmm. So that's a lot of what we're doing. And it's wonderful, speaking again about the parks that Sheena mentioned there. The park staff have been fantastic, particularly Liam Casey, who, you know, gave us permission to grow food in a public park.
Yeah.
It's quite something, you know. Yeah. And so not only now do we plant and grow food in these areas, we're very conscious of biodiversity, and we're very conscious that we share the space with these other creatures. And so it's not just about food growing, it's about the hedgerow in Toker, for example. Now we surrounded the garden with 350 trees for biodiversity, and we have installed a pond. We need a lot of ponds. We need ponds all over the city, actually, because, you know, in our country, 70% of our wetlands have been drained. Mm-hmm. So there's really nowhere anymore for frogs and all those insects, the aquatic insects, to go. And it's such a thing of beauty. It's after bringing so much joy to us. You know, that pond, it's only about 2 months old and already there's ducks in it.
Yeah.
And Aunt Tashka helped put it in with us. Now, when I say put it in, we actually decided to have a mail, and we put the word out there. We resisted the idea of bringing in a digger because we believe in bringing people together and working together, hard labour.
for your sins.
Yeah, for your sins. So we worked in it from about 8:30 in the morning until 4:30. And there's little opportunity for people to come together anymore and do those really physical sort of, you know, big tasks. And sure, everybody had a ball. It was just brilliant. And the sense of achievement afterwards was terrific because it was difficult work. And we had young and old. We'd men, women, boys, girls, the whole lot came along with their picks and their shovels and wheelbarrows. And Antashka guided us on the day, and we created a rather large pond. And, you know, the sense of achievement and satisfaction at seeing it. And we all learnt as we were doing it. So, yeah, I mean, I'd love to think that what we try out in Toker could be rolled out into other community gardens, you know. And that's what leads to resilient communities, yeah. That we care for one another.
Yeah, absolutely. That is vital, isn't it? It's the kind of foundation stone for it all.
So on that note, suffice to say, communities gathering together, individual change makers and activists, and collaboration between the City Council combined is vital. Stay tuned over the course of the series to hear more from our guests and the people of Cork, making it a more greener, healthier and more enjoyable place to live in. Thank you to my guests, Gina Johnson, Climate Action Officer at the Cork City Council, and Maria Young of Green Spaces for Health and the Cork Food Policy Council. If you'd like more information or would like to get involved, visit corkhealthycities.com and corkcity.ie.
Hours to Protect, brought to you by Cork's Red FM, the IBI, and funded by Commissioner Naman with a television licence fee. Check out hourstoprotect.ie for more info.